In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And this is the I Spy Radio Show. It's good to be back. Due to the tragedy in Southern Oregon, we played a best of last week that was more entertainment focused, just to give people a little space and time to heal. In addition to the shooting last week, there were two other big news items. Russian airstrikes in Syria and Hillary Clinton's emails may have been compromised after all. Longtime listeners of iSpy won't be surprised by the Russians hitting the so-called allies in Syria. Why? Because many of our allies there are splinter terrorist groups that include ISIS affiliates, Daesh, and other fundamental Islamics that are trying to oust Assad, who is a moderate. This follows the Obama doctrine: target moderate or secular Muslims for removal and install fundamental Muslims into power. We saw it in Egypt. We saw it in Libya. And last week at the UN, Vladimir Putin called out the Obama administration and the U.S.-sponsored Arab Spring, which supported the worst elements of radical Islam. If you're a longtime listener of iSpy, you know that more than 2 years ago, we exposed how Senator John McCain was deeply involved with Libya and the Syrian rebels. Not only that, but you also know that he was meeting and supporting rebels who went on to become ISIS leaders. Because McCain and Obama were so bent on removing Assad, they were willing to deal with rebels, any rebels, no matter how bad they were. Now, 2 years on, other media sources are finally waking up to this, and they're passing around a picture our guest pointed us to 2 years ago, John McCain meeting with ISIS leaders. One of these freedom fighters, as McCain and Obama like to call them, became known as the cannibal because he had himself filmed eating a human heart. More recently, we had a guest on who talked about the extreme vulnerability to hacking that Hillary's private email exposed the entire government to. I even wrote a blog about this. Last week, the FBI said that Hillary was the target of a phishing campaign. Hillary said there's no evidence of a breach, but of course that's just one more example of Hillary's ability to lie right to your face. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, it just means there's no evidence of it. But listeners of iSpy knew that this could happen, and that it eventually would be proven true, and it has. Now, if you have listened to iSpy, you know that I don't like to toot our own horn, because I figure that you're smart enough to remember things that we've said, and you don't need me to remind you. But I say all this to preface today's show, because I want you to pay very close attention to what we'll be talking about. So if you are a longtime listener, you probably know more about Oregon's healthcare transformation and its CCO model than most elected officials. And sadly, I learned last week that a Republican candidate for governor thinks CCOs are a good thing. So, once again, we may have a Republican candidate who doesn't understand the bigger picture, like we did last time with Dennis Richardson. Richardson voted for the CCOs. Okay, when is a government takeover of an industry ever a good thing? Government takeovers always lead to poor service, they're more expensive, and they're open for abuse. Because you're not customers, you're liabilities. You're not revenue for the system, you're an expense. And any expense needs to be mitigated. Which is why under the CCO model, you'll end up seeing the doctor fewer times. It's in their business model. An array of navigators and a whole bunch more, all designed to get you to go to the doctor as infrequently as possible, to not access the healthcare system, in other words, to not cause the government any more expense more than possible. We've covered in the past how the Green Movement is more about transferring money from taxpayers to Democrats and left-leaning organizations than it is about the environment. Tax monies in the forms of grants and funding for environmental projects go to left-leaning groups who learn skills of marketing and persuasion and how to lobby, and then donate that money to Democrats who get reelected and then give even more money to environmental groups, thus completing the environmentalist's great circle of life. Now, if you paid attention to the Planned Parenthood hearings, you heard, finally, someone say this. Representative Chaffetz said the Democrats fund Planned Parenthood, who donate exclusively to Democrats who, once in office, funnel money back to Planned Parenthood. And the great circle of politics continues. But the amount of money going to the environment and Planned Parenthood is peanuts in comparison to what is spent on healthcare in this country. For example, $22.2 billion in 2014 went to global warming, which goes entirely to left-leaning causes. But that pales in comparison to the more than $1.2 trillion the federal government spends in healthcare. Think how much damage the Democrats have been able to do with the funding they already have. $500 million to Planned Parenthood, $22.2 billion to global warming. Just wait until they start bleeding off funds from $1.2 trillion. And yet we have Republicans running for office who think this is a good idea. What has happened here in Oregon is a system ripe for abuse. And right on cue, another story you may have seen last week was an Inspector General's report that found $30 million was paid by Medicaid for ambulance rides that never happened. Just outright fraudulent billing. Now, what makes this especially scary is that here in Oregon, as part of our healthcare transformation, we've removed the ability to track payments per patient. We use a global budget, which means all funds are dumped into a single fund. So if the federal government budgets $10,000 for patient A and $20,000 for patient B, we don't really know if patient A received $10,000 in treatments or if patient B received $20,000 for their care. It could be five, it could be seven, or maybe 25 and two. Who knows? But you can be sure that they don't receive a total of $30,000 in care between them. Why? Because CCOs are, in effect, incentivized not to provide care because they get to keep what's left over. Think of it this way. If you send your kid to the grocery store with a $5 bill to buy a loaf of bread and tell them they can keep whatever is left over as a reward for doing it, are they going to buy the fancy all-organic loaf for $4.99? No. They're going to buy the generic store-brand loaf on sale for 99 cents. So what do you think is going to happen to the level and quality of care people get when CCOs are handed a pile of cash and said, here, go provide care, and we'll let you keep what's left over? It's already happening. A look at their financials showed that tens of millions of dollars is staying in CCOs' bank accounts rather than going to patient care. And what's happening here in Oregon's CCOs is in the process of being implemented by Obamacare in other states. Here in Oregon, they call them CCOs. Under Obamacare, they're ACOs, Accountable Care Organizations. Make no mistake, the Democrats will bleed money off of this trillion-dollar system. As I said, we know this because it's already happening. Remember that vicious cycle I mentioned a moment ago about Democrats giving to Planned Parenthood who elect Democrats who give more money to Planned Parenthood? Just in the most cursory of examination of the CCO's books, we've seen that CCOs have already given hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash to Democrat-friendly organizations, like Planned Parenthood. Isn't that nice? And we have Republican candidates who think Oregon's healthcare transformation and the CCO model is a good thing. Oh, and by the way, your insurance rates here in Oregon are going up an average of more than 20% next year. So on today's show, we're talking about healthcare, to get a handle on the current situation, to look at areas where fraud is likely to occur, where people can game the system, and to get an overall situation report on Oregon's healthcare transformation. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll be right back with our guest, Lisa Lettenmeyer. And welcome back to the iSpire Radio Show. I'd like to welcome Lisa Lettenmeyer. She's an independent insurance broker and business owner. Her company is HealthSource Northwest, and she is our source for insights into the healthcare industry and especially insurance and Medicaid, Medicare issues. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's always fun.
Yeah, you know, speaking of being back, it's been almost a year ago when we had you on to discuss the debacle of Cover Oregon. In case people have already forgotten, that was the failed healthcare exchange we'd set up here in Oregon. And the top issue during that show was a then-recent Oregonian article about Cover Oregon in which their own consultant, a corporate turnaround expert, Clyde Hamstreet, tore into the dysfunctional management of Cover Oregon, citing the following: little accountability, unprofessional conduct, ill will and poor cooperation between the exchange and Oregon Health Authority, poor communication, inadequate or missing policies and procedures, big surprise there, widespread discomfort and mistrust, weak financial controls, uncontrolled IT spending, piles of untouched work with no plans to address them. So now that Cover Oregon is no more, but are any of these issues still occurring under the federal exchange, or are there even new problems?
Well, our experience as we help people transition from Cover Oregon to the federal exchange was better. I mean, obviously the system was all online. It actually worked. You know, on the front end, we could get through to the federal exchange most of the time and get our questions answered and assist clients. So all of that went well, and everybody last year, if they were on CoverOregon, had to transition to the federal exchange or they had no coverage. What we found as we got through that enrollment cycle, when we got into, say, February, March of this year, we were getting quite a few phone calls and emails from clients who'd gone through the federal exchange and were now getting letters requesting documentation of their income or their residency status, and they were attempting to provide that to the government, either faxing it or mailing it in, and we're still getting letters, we didn't get anything from you, you're going to lose your subsidy if we don't get that in time. So I had, you know, numerous clients that were sending things in multiple times, and a lot of what was happening is the government wasn't willing to accept what they had. So there was no clarification or on what the government wanted for income verification, especially in regards to somebody who's a self-employed individual or small business owner, because you're really estimating for the year. So, and they weren't willing to give you direct advice. So that was a challenge. I do know a couple people that ended up losing their subsidy because they didn't get the information to the government in time in the format that they wanted. So that was a bit of a back-end hurdle. And we didn't see that particular problem the very first year because CoverOregon, at least from what I could see, didn't go back and verify incomes or status because obviously they had such a hard time just getting people in the door in the first place. So the federal exchange, way more oversight as far as that, definitely were kicking people off of subsidies that they couldn't prove their income. Mm-hmm. As we go into this next year, so I want your audience to realize if they've gone through the federal exchange and are receiving some form of a subsidy to help them with their premiums, they will potentially need to go back into that federal exchange at the very minimum to update their income. When you entered your data into the federal exchange, there's a question that comes up that says, do you want us to automatically renew your income information every year for the next 5 years, 3 years, or do you want to just come in and update it annually? And a lot of people picked the I'll update it annually because, of course, if your income changes and you don't tell the exchange, you may have deserved less subsidy and you'd have to owe it back later.
Well, let me interrupt you there for a second. What does that mean, automatically update that, as far as the government doing that? Does that mean they're snooping through your bank account? Does that mean they're watching your paychecks coming in? What does that mean?
My understanding is they can look to your tax returns. So if your tax returns look similar to the year before, then they would just, you know, let that go through.
Okay.
But if your income was showing up a lot different, they may come back to you to have verification. The problem is, and that's, you know, it's hard to get things confirmed at this point in time because things are, you know, we just recently were opened up and able to start training on the exchange. But there may be some issues if somebody said, nope, I want to renew that information every year. If they don't go in and get that done in the correct time frame, then they may not end up having coverage, or at the very minimum, they might not have their subsidy as they go into January. So I do encourage anybody who's gone through the exchange to at least go through, update your information. You may or may not want to change plans, but something to certainly be aware of.
Okay. Well, another issue that we had last year was the Washington Times had reported that that the Obamacare website was not going to reveal the new rates for 2015 until after the 2014 election. It didn't really help because the Democrats got their clocks cleaned in the 2014 election. But what was the end result of that? Did rates go up significantly from 2014 to 2015?
Not significantly from most, not most, but there was a handful of carriers that actually came down. So if you were looking at purchasing a plan in 2014, that year, all of our insurance carriers were making a huge guess. They had no idea, really, as far as claims history, how to price their plans for 2014, because it was the first year of the new ACA-compliant metallic level plans, guaranteed issue, no pre-existing, no, you know, no lifetime max. So it was a whole new frontier. And, you know, a lot of people know in the news that MOTA came in lower than most carriers, so they kind of took the majority of the market that first year in 2014. We expected huge shifts in 2015. MOTA did go up a little bit, but their average increase was like 10%, so they held on to a good portion of their business. However, other carriers who had been quite high in 2014 came down quite a bit in 2015 to try to get back into the market, like LifeWise and I think even Providence. So that was interesting to watch. We now know the rates as we go into 2016, and that's a whole another story. I mean, that's a big story.
Well, from what I understand, they're going up on average 25% or more, and some of them as high as 38%. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it depends on the carrier. So when you watch a carrier file their rates, what they do is they take all of their plans, all of their age bands, and they have to average the increases together. So as an example, Moda's average increase is 25%. However, depending on your age and or the plan that you bought, they have a couple of plans, one in particular, that's going up higher because of some changes in the plan design. Other carriers posted as high as a 50% average rate increase. Others tried to come in lower. Kaiser was a pretty minimal price increase. What was fascinating to watch this year is that not only did we see bigger price increases than we had historically, for sure, because this was really, as the carriers were filing for 2016, it was truly their first year of having a full 12 months of claims data.
Yeah.
And what we saw was they lost a lot of money off of that 2014 book of business. And we saw that reflective in the 2016 rate.
Yeah, and so that explains the big increases. All right, coming up, we'll do a checkup on Obamacare. I think you can pretty much forget about that $2,500 of healthcare savings per family that Obama promised. But what's the industry look like now that some of Obamacare has been phased in? And we're back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Keep an eye on healthcare today. And to do that, we're always honored to have Lisa Lettenmeyer to help us dissect things and try to make some sense of things, as at least as much as possible in a nonsensical system. Her website is healthsourcenw.com, if you want to go visit that. And, of course, we'll always put that up on iSpyRadio.com, too. So last year, you know, actually we talked a little bit about this going out of that last segment there, some of these rate increases that we're seeing. And last year, when we had you on, the National Review had reported that, quote, one large health insurer, Humana, is going to need to be paid between $250 and $450 million to make up for losses for Obamacare in 2014. And like we said at the end of that last segment there, that's kind of what we're seeing now happening here in Oregon.
Right. So when we go back, so it's really hard for the consumer to kind of keep track of where things are at because the carriers are always trying to file almost a year ahead of time. So in the April of this year, the carriers were filing for rates that they're going to charge January of 2016. So you're way ahead, right? You're trying to balance this out. So all they could really use was their actual claims data from 2014 and the first quarter trend of 2015. And you are correct. In 2014, there were quite a few carriers across the nation that had some pretty substantial losses. Moda was one of them. They made it into the top 15 carriers in the nation. Roughly speaking, their loss was somewhere around $80 million or a little more.
Ouch.
And the carriers had somewhat planned for that because there were these reinsurance programs going on. There were three different programs. They're kind of complicated to dissect, but the gist of it is the first two programs were there to help make the carriers whole. So if a carrier took on or had more claims than another carrier, all the carriers paid in, and the carriers that took a harder hit got some payment back. So the idea is Moda should hopefully get most, if not all, of that $80 million or whatever that actual final number was to help make them whole. There was some disputes whether that was going to happen or not. Did the government have enough teeth to actually get everybody to contribute? It sounds like that's working itself out, but that's where we're at. Those two programs, those first two of the three, will sunset this year, I believe it is.
Hmm.
So we're going to be moving into a dynamic where, you know, the theory is everybody's kind of gotten in. The pent-up demand of health claims should be kind of blending out, and we should be able to go forward, and there will still be some, you know, risk corridors that we can look at. But that's what happened there. So when the carriers were filing rates for 2015, they didn't at that point know because they were literally filing rates in April of 2014 on what they wanted to charge for 2015, which is one of the big reasons that we didn't see big price increases for 2015 because they didn't have any data yet. 2016 rates are different. We now know that here in Oregon, of our large carriers, I think the top 10 carriers, they collectively spent in claims about $823 million. That's what they physically spent in claims collectively. But also collectively, they only took in $703 million. So our carriers as a whole lost $120 million for 2014,
wow.
And the trend was showing the same for the first quarter of 2015. When the carriers filed in April for the 2016 rates, they now knew that data. The other thing that happened is they all filed for rate increases across the board. Some were pretty negligible like Kaiser, but everybody else was fairly substantial, most of them double digits and pretty high double digits. And we've seen our insurance division, our Oregon insurance division has got huge oversight. We probably have one of the most robust oversight systems in the nation as far as keeping an eye on insurance carriers, their rates, and is it applicable to what they're experiencing with business. Now, for me, I've been in the business for 12 years. This was the first time that I saw across the board that not only was the insurance division allowing the carriers to keep those rate increases that they were asking for, because usually they get knocked down a few points at least,
mm-hmm.
but in addition, there were four or five carriers that were told, you need to actually charge more than what you just thought you would charge. Yeah. So we hadn't seen that. I hadn't seen that in the last 12 years of doing this job. So that was fascinating. And the reason now and the rationale is, of course, the whole purpose of insurance is it's a business arrangement. That insurance company is taking in premiums from the many to pay the claims that come in of theoretically the smaller percentage of that. Usually on average about 25% of your clients will have pretty significant claims. So if the carrier is spending more than they're taking in, that's not a good position for any business. And the insurance division takes a hard look at that because if the carrier can't remain financially solvent, they can't fulfill the promise to the consumer, and therefore they could actually go out of business. The insurance division could shut them down. So having those carriers get those rate increases and or in some cases going even higher was to keep those carriers financially solvent.
Well, what's interesting on that is, like you said, you can't spend more than you take in unless, of course, you're the government. But what's interesting on that is it makes me wonder why the insurance division is looking at doing that. Do you think that they are perhaps seeing even bigger cost increases coming down the road?
Well, like I said, not only did they see this huge loss collectively for the 2014 business, but the trend in that first quarter of 2015 was trending the exact same way, the same numbers. So as all the carriers this year had to have their rate filings and plan designs in by April 30th. That was the deadline for everybody. So we had 12 months plus the first quarter of actual, here's what's happening with our claims, and everybody saw that reflective in the rates. Obviously, the insurance division was really watching that, which is why we saw kind of an odd thing where the insurance division said, in some cases, they didn't agree with the insurance carrier. They thought that they were underpricing, and they wanted them to go even higher.
It really is astounding to hear how much insurance is going up. I mean, the whole reason we were doing all of this was it was going to supposedly save people money. Are they looking at any kind of savings coming down the road?
Well, but here's for anybody to think that insurance wasn't going to go up, it was kind of a foolhardy idea because.
Yeah.
You went from an insurance product. Insurance is fully developed off of a risk assessment. What's your risk? That's what you pay. We took, as a government, we took that ability away from the insurance carrier, especially in the individual marketplace.
Yes.
We told the insurance carrier, you cannot assess risk. You ask the age, you ask where they live, and are they a smoker or non-smoker? That is it. They have no ability to ask anything else other than those three questions to determine their rate. And then whatever the client comes in the door with, pre-existing or not, pending surgeries or not, that's what the carrier has to pay. And there's no lifetime maximum that the carrier gets to stop at.
Wow.
They have to pay indefinitely if it's qualified medical expenses. And we've capped how much somebody's out-of-pocket could be. So worst case this year was $6,600. Next year, the worst case out of pocket is like $6,800. So no matter what plan you're buying out there in an individual market, there is no longer a $10,000 or $15,000 out of pocket max to drive your premium down. They're all in basically the same bucket almost.
Mm.
And we have 100% preventative coverage, which includes birth control, sterilization for women, colorectal screenings, which are all great things to have, but those are not cheap medical expenses.
No,
and now the carrier has to cover all of that at 100%.
Yeah, wow, shocking. All right, we do need to take a break here. Coming up, the ease with which the system can be gamed. It's Healthcare Today on the iSpy Radio Show, but we're taking you behind the headlines and taking a deeper look at what's really happening. We're doing that with Lisa Lettmeyer, an independent insurance broker and business owner who has studied the healthcare exchanges that have been implemented all across the country. Her website is HealthSource Northwest. That's healthsourcenw.com. In fact, I liked one of the comments there on your website. This is a customer who said that Lisa is a rock star in the complex world of private health care insurance exchange. So we always like rock stars on our show. That's awesome. So, all right. So before we get into the fraud issues, because there was an article out this week talking about some of the fraud for Medicare and these ambulance rides that just simply didn't happen. There was an interesting article in the Statesman Journal back in March, and it talked about the skyrocketing costs of drugs and prescription drugs. So why exactly are these prices skyrocketing?
Yeah, so there, you know, to me, there's a direct correlation to some of the changes that affected that were built into the Affordable Care Act. So we all know, or anybody who's in Medicare now knows, that there is a drug program for Medicare beneficiaries. It's Medicare Part D. And it came out, it was the first year you could actually buy a plan was 06, but it wasn't perfect in its initial design because you basically had, the idea with the government was that the consumer was covered 75% for their overall drug cost, they were left paying 25%. But that only went to a certain point of drug cost, and then you fell into what we call the coverage gap or donut hole. Now, at that point, back in those first plan designs, that meant that the consumer had to pay 100% of their drug costs while they were in the coverage gap. In the Affordable Care Act, the Obama administration worked a deal with the drug manufacturers wherein he wants to close that coverage gap over time, which is a good goal. Of course, you don't want senior citizens paying 100% all of a sudden when they were only paying 25%. But how we accomplish that is, first of all, it's over a 10-year span. The idea is at the end of that, at 2020, the consumer on average should be paying 25% for their drug costs. The biggest key piece of it, though, was on brand name drugs. So the deal was made with the drug manufacturers. You need to give our Medicare beneficiaries up to a 50% discount for their brand name drugs while they are in the coverage gap. So not before and not after, but just in the coverage gap. And they, and the Obama administration got that concession. But what I have seen as I work with my clients over the past couple of years, I have seen a trend that generic drugs are magically going up in price. Now, are they absolutely right? I mean, can I say categorically they're related? No, because I'm not in there. I don't work for those drug manufacturers. But it seems that it would make sense if the drug manufacturers can collect less money on brand names. Of course, they were going to shift that loss right on over to the generics. If I was in business, that's what I would have done. So.
Well, yeah, and that article had mentioned that some people were paying between $3,000 and $10,000 per month for some of these prescriptions. I mean, that's just astounding. But with all of this money floating around, in this segment, I really want to talk about the ease with which the system can be gamed. And like I said earlier, there was this article that came out that an inspector's general report had found that $30 million of Medicare had been paid out to non-existent ambulance rides. The rides just flat out never happened. And they're not exactly sure why this happened or how this happened and why there was this loophole here. But it's interesting when you look at this sort of thing because people think of crony capitalism as really bad, where mega corporations collude with government to enrich themselves at the expense of the taxpayer. And that is bad. And yet most people somehow think this wouldn't or doesn't happen in the medical industry. But how prevalent would you guess is fraud within the system?
Well, it's actually very substantial, so much so that anybody who works within the Medicare industry, so whether you're an insurance carrier, you're an employee of an insurance carrier, you're an insurance agent, you're an employee of an insurance agent, we all have to now go through fraud, waste, and abuse training. For the very reason that, A, it's teaching us what, you know, if we're in the business, what we shouldn't be doing, which we should already know that because of ethics, but also more importantly, it's teaching us how to recognize the signs of potential fraud that's out there. And fraud can occur in so many different ways. It can be perpetrated by the consumer, by a pharmacist, by a doctor, by a hospital, clearly by an ambulance company. And some of it is intentional, and some of it is just laziness or bad business. If you're talking about a consumer, one of the ways that we seem pretty prevalent is that a consumer will go doctor shopping. And what that means is they might have four or five different doctors, and every time they go to a doctor, they conveniently forget to, you know, to tell that doctor that they're seeing another doctor who's already given them some prescriptions. So they'll go and get pain meds or muscle relaxers or whatever it is, and they'll get them from every doctor and then fill them, and then they could actually resell them. That's a pretty big business. You could see it at the pharmacist level, because you could have a consumer going in and they were prescribed a brand name, but the pharmacist always has the option to say, hey, we can give you the generic, or maybe they don't say. So the pharmacist could theoretically fill a brand name drug as a generic. How would the consumer really know? Because it's, who knows what the color of the pill should be, but yet they bill then the insurance carrier for the brand name pricing. A doctor can do it either willfully or just through bad practices by ordering too many tests too frequently. You might go from one doctor who had you do an MRI to another doctor a week later, and he says, hey, I want a new MRI. And is it really necessary that, a week later? So ordering multiple tests that aren't necessary, or, billing for things where you didn't really do anything. I hear it all the time. I have clients that actually look at their bills. They teach them to be a consumer, and they'll say, I was in the hospital, and I'm going through this bill, and there's this guy that billed me $700. And I figured it out because my wife wrote down everybody's name. The guy walked in, said, how are you doing, looked at my chart, and walked out, and I was billed $700. So it can happen in a lot of different ways. Hospitals could maybe admit somebody that ultimately didn't need to be admitted because they weren't sure yet. The hospital might release somebody. You could argue that they released them too soon, or maybe the hospital thought that they were stable, but they ended up coming back and had a quick readmit. So, again, it could be fraud, waste, or abuse, but it's pervasive, especially in the Medicare world.
Yeah, well, and it all certainly adds up to, just a phenomenal amount of money going around and, of course, ripe for abuse. And speaking of ripe for abuse, we're going to come up in the next segment where we'll be talking about Oregon and how they have made themselves even more ripe for abuse. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Keep an eye on big government. Lisa Lettmeyer is our guest today. She's an independent insurance broker and business owner. Her website is healthsourcenw.com. If you'd like to go give her a visit. And so we're talking about some of the fraud and the prevalence of fraud. Just real quick, what would you guess is the average? One in 500 cases, one in 1,000?
Oh, as far as that goes, I don't know those numbers. I just know that it is a pervasive problem.
Just
that
curious.
We're trained on.
Your educated guess.
Yeah. Educated guess.
Yeah.
I'd say out of 10 cases, probably fraud could occur easily in at least one or two, if not higher, just because it's not just fraud. Like I said, it's fraud, waste, or abuse. So it could come in different categories.
10%, that's pretty astounding then, if that's the case. So of course, we've got a situation here in Oregon where we have created a system that is absolutely ripe for abuse because they put in this global budget where Medicare and Medicaid dump all of their money into essentially a giant piggy bank, but then lose the ability to track who is being paid what for what. Are you hearing about any kinds of safeguards that the Oregon Health Authority is putting into place to make the system less vulnerable to fraud?
I haven't heard about that, but I have definitely heard pushback from some of those community care organizations feeling like they're not getting reimbursed appropriately, which then, of course, affects how they pay their doctors and their facilities and how they operate, because it's really specifically Medicaid money. Medicare hasn't been swallowed in yet, that to my knowledge. But what's happening is that the state, when you're dealing with Medicaid, you've got state dollars and federal dollars. And so the money pours in, and there's this pot of money. And so what Oregon did, which was unique for Oregon, I believe we're the only ones doing this so far because we're on a new program, we divided that pot of money into the, I think it's 22 different community care organizations. So based upon where they're at and their clientele, they get a certain dollar amount. But that's it. They kind of have to make it work that year. So if you get more clients coming in than you planned on, that could be problematic. I saw an article where I believe it was Family Care was pushing back twice and to the point of wanting to sue the Oregon Health Authority because they felt that their reimbursement rates were lower than their competitor in the same area, in the Portland metro area, and that was creating strife. The whole idea behind the CCO is that rather than reimburse doctors on a fee-for-service system, which is what we've historically always done, you go in and you have a diagnosis code or a treatment code, and that's what they're paid on. The idea is you're paid on outcome-based. So the community care organizations
just to back up a little bit, you mean we have moved from the fee-for-service where you go in, see the doctor, pay for that service, and now we're shifting towards the outcome-based.
That's what they're trying to do. Right.
Yes.
And so Oregon is a guinea pig for that. And you could argue both sides. The where I see things is when you're going from one system to the next, because we can easily argue that the FIFR system has room for improvement, but if you're going to this completely other program, I see the unintended consequences. I hear about them from people that call in. If you're on a Medicaid program, you're really right now being told which community care organization you belong to, and that dictates your care, mm-hmm. your doctors, the facilities, when you can come in, how often you can come in, what they're going to send you out for. It's all being hyper-managed. It's like the old original style of a gatekeeper with an HMO.
Yes.
If you're not able to get in time, if you're not being listened to, if the person is working off of a time frame and they've got to run you through, that could be certainly problematic. The other issue I have, and I'm hearing this not just in the Medicaid world, but I'm starting to hear it now in how they're designing Medicare insurance products, and we're even starting to see it kind of blend into how they design health insurance products. And let me be clear, this isn't necessarily the insurance carrier driving it. The government's behind them pushing it forward. But it's this idea of if we can get people to come in for their preventative care and do a health assessment, which is a health questionnaire, so we know what's going on with them. We ask them family history and blah, blah, blah. And then we also make sure that if they're on a maintenance drug, that they're taking it. That seems to be the idea of, you know, perfect cases, right, that we're managing people. I would argue, and I'm not going to say that getting preventative exams is not a good idea, but it doesn't catch everything. And I also would argue that just because you put somebody on a maintenance drug doesn't mean that we're done. Because I see, as I work with my Medicare clients year after year, that they are either on more drugs or the drugs that they are on, we're upping the doses because the symptoms that the drug was meant to basically mask over aren't gone. They're just being artificially altered. The body is still throwing out the symptom. We're just giving it a chemical to make the symptom go away. So then the body finally says, I'll get louder. And it gets louder, and then you have to up the dose or add another drug. So are we really talking about health care at that point, or are we just talking about health management? I like to see health care, where we get to the root problem and try to fix it through lifestyle or whatever that might be. Not to say that there's not a place for maintenance drugs, but I don't want it to be the check a box and move somebody on, which is how I feel things are starting to head towards.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you. And I think there's also a lot of areas for abuse in this system, and not least of which is the fact that the bureaucrats are going to be helping to decide how well they're doing, which is essentially you're giving yourself the grade. I mean, they're administering this huge bureaucracy, and then they are also the ones in terms of deciding how well they're doing. All right, let's take a break a little bit early. More on this when we come back with Lisa Lettmeyer. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're into our final segment now on the iSpy Radio Show, talking today to Lisa Lettmeyer. She's an independent insurance broker and business owner and our go-to girl for all things insurance and healthcare related. So, Lisa, we've been talking about this shift now from outcomes-based reimbursement or to outcomes-based reimbursement. And this is something we've been warning people about. When all of that attention was being paid to the healthcare exchange and that huge debacle, what we kept trying to tell people about was, it's not, that's how you pay for your health care, but now how the health care itself that you're paying for is being changed. And so one of my big concerns as a consumer is this notion of the increasing power of the governmental bean counter and bureaucrats. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's one of those things, I've been talking to a lot of people about it, and I equate it back to that frog in the pot of water. As it gets hotter, he has no realization that he's actually being cooked. He just sits there. And that's kind of how I feel we're heading. And that might seem extreme, but here's why I think that. When we, again, you can argue on both cases, fee-for-service or outcomes-based. I just want people to make a shift and do it looking at the big picture and all the potential unintended consequences.
Yeah.
Our doctors are being incented financially to move to outcome-based care. Which, again, in some cases I'm sure works great, but there are some areas where it might not work great if you're not getting in to see your doctor or they're not listening to you and they are the ultimate one checking a box, right? And they get paid for making sure everybody is, you know, doing all the same things. Then behind them, the way that they were incented was by the insurance carrier. So the insurance carrier is the one, you know, incenting the doctor by paying them more, but the insurance carrier is being incented also. So we obviously saw that in Oregon with the CCOs, because that was a special program that you know, again, Oregon's been a guinea pig on, where the government says we're going to change how we deal with Medicaid here in Oregon and see if this works. But we're also starting to see that trend move into the Medicare Advantage world, so Medicare Advantage plans or Medicare health plans. And in those, the Medicare Advantage plans are star rated. They're given a rating of 1 to 5. And if a carrier can achieve a 4-star or higher, they actually get additional funding, because that's how the carriers stay afloat, is they get funding from the federal government. So the government's saying, score high, we give you more money. That sounds brilliant. But as you look at the 60 different grading points that a carrier works off of, a big majority of them are on the health of their clients. And the three main categories they're looking at, as I mentioned earlier, are you getting them to come in for their routine physicals? Are you getting a health assessment? And are they taking their maintenance meds? In so much as for the carriers are now figuring out ways to incent people to go on to a mail order system, because then they can prove that the clients are taking their maintenance meds on a regular basis. So the government is ultimately kind of behind that. We're going to start to see, I've already heard talk, as we see how the government's, you know, allowing the carriers to design their pre-65 health plans, kind of heading in that same direction, right? Where we're behind the scenes, the government's just kind of slowly incenting carriers in one way or the other to perform in a certain way. And then that carrier moves on and incents the doctors to perform in a certain way. And I'm not, again, saying that preventative care and health assessments aren't good. They're all good. But I also think it can sometimes be a false sense of security, because we certainly know of times where things aren't caught during the routine exams. People aren't as communicative or willing to be honest on health questionnaires. And taking a maintenance drug does not mean you fix a problem. So those are the things I like to push back on and get people talking. So I'm not medically trained. I don't have a medical background. That's just my impressions of what I've
heard. And I think you're right, because as I look at this, it's more about kind of churning the system and making people kind of feel like they're on this kind of healthcare treadmill in a way, that you're kind of in the system and you're doing all these things and aren't you supposed to be feeling healthy? But there's, at some point, you know, when I look at those kinds of things, you'd like to get people off of that treadmill, and because they're then cured. And there seems to be less and less talk of that in terms of actually fixing the problem.
Now, I will say, playing devil's advocate, if you're a doctor or an insurance carrier, it's really hard to motivate a consumer to do the healthy thing. You know, it's really, really hard. There are tons of wellness programs put out by insurance carriers, and that might be a gym membership, or you might be incented to have a little bit of dental built in, or a vision exam, or, you know, healthy eating, or smoking cessation. Those are all awesome things, and we do need to have that conversation with our society, because ultimately, we can never, ever change the cost of health insurance, which everybody focuses on, until we change the cost of health care. And some of the biggest drivers of health care dollars is really how we all live.
Right, but
it's harder to change people when they're older, but we, you know, we just need to look at different opportunities for sure.
But of course, the other problem is, because we have taken off this idea of risk, now people can do more riskier things like smoke or skydive or whatever, and no insurance person can ask you about those things.
Yeah, so that is a true statement. So they're constantly battling this back and forth of how, you know, how are you going to change that healthcare cost curve? So obviously, we talked about some of it today. We talked about fraud. We talked about prescriptions. 25% of all medical costs in America every year are just prescriptions only. We talked about keeping, you know, basically having people come in and just maintaining their potentially unhealthy lifestyle by just giving them a quick fix pill. You know, I know doctors are having conversations about changing lifestyles, but it doesn't always happen if they've got a pill that changes it for them.
Yeah, so. Unfortunately, I think what we're seeing is that we're trusting government now more than we are trusting consumers. Lisa Lettenmeyer, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me back.
All right, bye-bye. Lots of good reasons to visit iSpyRadio.com after the show. That recent article exposing what we exposed about John McCain 2 years ago, and the photo of him meeting with known terrorists, articles on the CCOs and other links mentioned during today's show, and a link to the podcast for today's show, all right there. We do try to make it easy on you so you can share them with your friends and your elected officials who need to hear this. Because the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.